Discuss, challenge, inform, comment, viewpoint on Talk Radio Europe. Giles Brown.
Live comment and discussion with studio guests.
Viewpoint.
The time is 5 minutes past 10. It is Tuesday, the 5th of February. You're listening to Viewpoint Talk Radio's current affairs programme with a panel of invited guests where we discuss the issues of the day with you for the next hour and 55 minutes. This morning we've got a bit of a special viewpoint, and we're joined by the BBC's business correspondent Rob Young, who's in Spain for a few days. Good morning, Rob. We're very pleased to have you here.
Just morning. It's lovely to be here. The weather is, shall I say, considerably better than it was when I was in London.
Was it minus something? You were wiping the ice off the cat?
It wasn't quite minus something, but it was snowing.
Right.
And I did have to wear both a shirt, a jumper, scarf, coat and gloves. Just to get from my flat 10 minutes along the road to get the train to work.
Marvellous. We miss that so much down here on the coast and on the islands. What actually are you... I mean, it's very nice to have you here with us, but what are you actually doing here at the moment?
So the BBC World Service has a couple of special programmes this week. World Business Report, live from Spain, looking at what Brexit, which of course is just 50-odd days away, will mean for Spain... and for many of the British expats who live here, because although we are in Spain, I've been very struck since I've been here, not quite 24 hours, at the number of signs that are in English, how English is spoken, it seems, by everybody in the restaurants and the cafes I've been into.
You've got that look of the rabbit in the headlights look about how you actually how it works in expatriate Spain, as it were.
Well, I had a rather nice full English breakfast this morning. So in some respects, it's great, isn't it?
Talking about fully English breakfast and all things food, delighted to be joined seamlessly in the studio by Rex Leyland. Good morning to you, Rex.
Good morning, Giles. Good morning, everybody. And it's lovely to be back in sunny Spain and on the Costa del Sol.
You've just moved, but come back over again from London as well?
I came last Wednesday, and we're just here for a short break and to soak up some of that fantastic sun. I love the winter sun. You have to work at it. You've got to really strive to get it. The summer sun is given to you, but the winter sun, I think, is the best.
And one person who enjoys the weather all year round is, of course, John Harper. John, our resident expat, or our resident...
Oh, no, resident immigrant, definitely.
They're immigrants.
I'm just here to... stir up people, really. That's all.
Well, so there we have our resident rebel rouser then is here with the show, John Harper. 952-78-4000 is the phone number. Studio at tre.radio, the email. The Facebook page, if you wish to get involved and leave a post, I would love to hear from you, is Talk Radio Official. And you can WhatsApp me on +34 645 99 67 95. It's going to be Brexit. We're also going to be speaking to Dmitry Gobrozinski, who is the founder of Explain Trade, a former Australian trade negotiator at the WTO and founder of Explain Trade, explaining why trading on WTO rules in the event of a no-deal Brexit will vastly increase the workload of businesses in all shapes and forms. So we're going to him in about 10 minutes or so. If you've got any questions about WTO rules and a no-deal Brexit, I spoke to Dmitry a little bit earlier on today, so looking forward to that. But first of all, let's have a look at what's making the front pages in the UK and further afield. Liam Neeson and Greg Clark, Nissan letter on the front pages, looking across the UK press this morning. Starting off with the fallout from the decision of Nissan to go back on its pledge to build their new model in Sunderland, making the front pages for a third day. And it's Business Secretary Greg Clark in the spotlight this time, following the emergence of a letter he wrote to the carmaker's former boss in 2016, promising its operations would not be adversely affected by Brexit. The Guardian's financial editor Niels Prattley describes the letter, which also mentioned millions of pounds in state aid being available to the firm on the condition it produced two models in Sunderland, as embarrassing. Not only was the minister making promises he couldn't underwrite, he says, but Nissan is free to reapply for the cash and could be confident of getting a thumbs up. The government will not want to risk damage to supply chains around Sunderland. The episode has, according to the Daily Telegraph, Mr. Clark fighting to save his reputation. Another man facing criticism is actor Liam Neeson, who was pictured on several front pages. The Hollywood star told the independent online newspaper he once went out on the streets with a cosh, hoping to be confronted by a black man so he could beat them to death in revenge for the rape of a loved one. He now says he feels ashamed of his actions, but the Sun says there's been a furious reaction to his comments, with some people calling for a boycott of his latest film. And at last, to a law to protect children online is the Daily Mail's front page headline, as it reports social media firms are to be forced to protect young and vulnerable users. It says the crackdown is to be announced by Digital Minister Margot James, who will say voluntary codes have failed. Looking at the front page of our media partner El País in English, from secretary studies to secret police, Spain's female officers mark 40 years on the force. Since 1979, the number of women in blue has jumped from 41 to more than 9,000. But as they explained, sexism remains an issue. The unsung heroes of the impossible mission to rescue Julien Rosello, the hundreds of people who helped locate the two-year-old in a 110-meter deep borehole, are struggling to come to terms with their experience. And government fears approach to Catalan independence will end in failure. The Socialist Party administration has made a series of gestures to appease pro-secession parties, but the efforts could have been in vain if its budget plan is rejected. That's what making the front page in the El País in English website. 952-784-4000, the phone number, studio at tre.radio, the email, the Facebook page, Talk Radio Europe Official, and you can WhatsApp us on +34 645 99 67 95. But we'll kick off with, well, we're going to kick off with this whole show to the issue of Brexit. A busy week as always, less than 50 days now to go. Rob, just we'll start kick off with you, as you're the new boy, so to speak. We'll put you in the hot seat to begin with before we kick off. We've had this announcement this weekend from Sunderland. Nissan won't be building its models. Brexiteers have been saying that this is, evidence that this is not going to work.
So I covered the Nissan story for the BBC over the weekend, and this is not 100% about Brexit. So back in 2016, Nissan was looking around, where was it going to build a couple of new models of cars? Britain was clearly keen that that work were to go to its big plant in Sunderland, the biggest car plant in the UK. And we've now had the details of a letter that was written by the business secretary, Greg Clark, to the then boss of Nissan, Carlos Ghosn. And in it, he said that there would be rather attractive financial packages available to Nissan to the tune of up to £80 million if it chose to build these new models in Sunderland, and that's what happened. But at the weekend, we had Nissan reversing that investment decision, and there are a number of factors. We are buying fewer cars in the European Union now. We seem to have gone off diesel. A few years ago, governments were pushing diesel in a big way. Drivers liked the fuel efficiency they got, but some of the economies in Europe are going through a bit of a rough patch at the moment. We're buying fewer cars. We're certainly buying fewer diesel cars, and therefore the business case for Nissan to build the X-Trail 4x4, which is powered by diesel, in Sunderland is just no longer there. But they also, in their letter to staff in Sunderland, said that Brexit, the uncertainty that there is still around this, because, of course, it's 52 days till the UK leaves the EU, and we don't know what trading terms will be between the UK and the EU. They said that was making it hard for them to plan for the future. Now, big businesses tend to stay out of politics, yet Nissan chose to put that line in their statement. So not all saying Brexit is the big defining element of this, because it wasn't, but just pointing out that it's part of this. But of course, as you'd expect, it's been taken up as part of the political argument. People who are pro-EU say, look, this is the beginning of the end, and people who think the UK will be totally fine if there's no deal say this has absolutely nothing to do with Brexit.
Rex, your take on this one?
Well, as I've just been listening to Rob, I've just suddenly thought of something. What would one say if this was a scheme on the part of the French, who are in partnership with Nissan, to stab us in the back? I joke, of course.
I joke. Well,
I mean, look at what's going on in Japan with the ex boss of Nissan Renault. It doesn't encourage any of us to go and want to work in Japan. That's for sure. I do think there is a knee-jerk reaction on the part of the Ramonas, saying that, this is just another thing that Brexit is horrible. The fact that the diesel car is undoubtedly the poison. We have to look back at what Volkswagen did to people like me and many others with our asthma and the terrible scandal of pollution. Rob is absolutely right. I'm afraid diesel is out. I remember the successive governments encouraging us all to go efficient and buy diesel, and how quickly things have changed. It's unfortunate that the timing of this announcement is literally 50 days before we say goodbye. But sadly, it is business, and business is competitive. And if you're in the marketplace, you have to take the rough with the smooth. If it was so easy, we'd all be doing it, and it's not. But Nissan's workforce are probably considered to be the best in the world as far as many other manufacturers say. And I think that there will be a future, but it'll just be perhaps another model. But when? We'll have to wait and see.
A future with another model. John?
Yeah. I mean, I think you've got two things. First off, Sunderland was very, very, very much a Brexit area. It's a leave area. There's no doubt about that. So Nissan's workforce, if you like, voted for Christmas, if this has anything to do with Brexit. Secondly, I don't think you can guarantee to rely, I wouldn't rely on the propaganda from either side at the moment. You've got Project Fear on one side, and you've got we're going to be okay and let's get back to the 50s on the other. So you've got a situation, I lived in the 50s, I liked it actually. So you've got a situation where you can't guarantee either side's propaganda at the moment. So I don't trust what the government's saying, I don't trust what Leave UK, EU say either, because they're all vested interests, and I wouldn't trust Leave EU any more than I would, no disrespect, but the BBC, right, to give me reliable information, because there are vested interests, and you have to accept that in today's world. We're looking in a world where, whichever way we look at it, there are vested interests that are going to actually push and promote a point of view. Sincerely, they believe that what they're doing is the best thing. 85% of MPs in Parliament represent constituencies. Their Remain MPs, 68.25% of constituency MPs actually represent Leave constituencies, where over 60% on an average voted to leave. And still they stand up in Parliament, and as MPs, they vote for Christmas by saying, no, we actually sincerely believe we've got to try and keep Remain, we've got to keep a close deal with the EU. They believe that. I don't argue with them. They believe that. That's fine. But the fact is, the people who elected them don't believe that. There's your conflict.
Going in on the WhatsApp, +34 645 99 67 95. This in from Richard in London saying, oh, it's totally about Brexit. Sunderland still makes Qashqais, Duke Q30, QX30 with diesel engines. Besides, the X Trail is also sold with petrol engines, so why not build it in Sunderland with petrol only? VAG weren't the only culprits, and the cheat itself is not very serious. It simply meant that the vehicle ECU recognised that the car was not being steered, and the situation, it altered the parameters of the engine to reduce NXO emissions to a level below which this car has been driven normally. So in traffic, driving slowly in a straight line, such as city traffic, NX would be reduced as it's for the tests and pedestrians on pavements in cities, which would not actually suffer from inhaling too much of the stuff. And Goshen was arrested for fraud, no Japanese conspiracy. We go live to the lines, no 952 784,000, and I go live to the lines, and as my Welsh grandmother would say, there he was, gone. One in from Graham saying, if the EU had not been so determined to dismantle democracy and offer a sham of democracy in name only, if they had listened to the cries of the citizens to stop building an unaccountable and dictatorial state run by presidents of commissions and councils who are not elected by a democratic vote of the citizens and cannot be removed by a democratic vote of the people, if they had not tried to destroy the colourful cultures of 28 nations by trying to homogenise everything, make endless laws and regulations which stifle small businesses and entrepreneurs and favour multinationals and global conglomerates while suffocating creativity and competition, introduce an irresponsible irresponsible and destructive immigration policy, which has caused intense social disharmony and resentment. Then Brexit would not have happened. Now they want to create a mighty army to threaten the Russians. This will not bring peace, only the increased chance of conflict on a large scale. We have not learned from the suffering that empire building has caused through history. The EU is the greatest threat to European democracy that still exists on this planet today. Graham, they're not mucking around there.
Who is that?
That's Graham.
Graham's got it all in one, hasn't he? Talk about it, encapsulation. My God.
Graham has written the longest WhatsApp in history.
Exactly. It's good content.
He's been on the air 30 minutes.
We all have it on our computers down here so we can type into it.
Let's go live to the lines. Good morning, caller. You're live on TRE. What's your name? I told you we were different, Rob. What's your name? Where are you calling from? What's your viewpoint, please?
Kate Costa-Blanca.
Morning, Kate.
You've just given a peculiar kind of distortion of reality, I think. There was not a single fact in that lot. In fact, you know, there were a large number of lies, deliberate lies. What do you want us to talk about?
Well, I mean, it's your viewpoint, Kate, so please, kick off.
Well, Sunderland is an example of precisely why Brexit is very wrong. If I were building a business or trying to, would I have any confidence in the British government at the moment? I mean, it's the farcical. And we've only got 53 days, I've forgotten the exact number. But
52 days, I'm being told.
And they're still playing around with, you know, refinements of the deal that they have changed two or three times. And the country seems to be run by a small group of nutcases called the European Research Group. And this is quite terrible, particularly since a larger number of people ask clearly for Remain. And we are not being allowed to vote on it. That is criminal.
Kate, going to cut you short there for a little bit and go live to another line. It's very busy this morning, 952-78-4000. Good morning, caller, you're live on TRE. What's your name? Where are you calling from? What's your viewpoint, please?
Good morning, everyone. Raymond from Mallorca.
Good morning, Raymond.
It's about, my viewpoint is about Nissan. Okay, I can remember, it goes back far enough to when they first started. It was basically, we'll build a car factory in your country, but, you know, it's expensive and we need help. So the government then, at the time, gave them grants, tax concessions. Of course, they promised to stay. I believe Nissan was the first one, and then the others followed suit. So what we're seeing now is we are seeing what happens when you sell off your industries. Okay, of course, Nissan was never British, but what happened to British car manufacturers were taken over by foreigners. This is what happens. You are no longer in control. So what's happened with Nissan? There's something's happened recently which could have an influence on what's just happened with the X-Trail production. And that is last week, Japan and the European Union signed a trade agreement. Now, they plan to phase out tariffs on Japanese motor cars within the next 10 years. Now, we do know, I don't think it's scaremongering to say some of the European EU referendum negotiators are hostile towards the United Kingdom. Okay, it's possible. This is just a theory. Isn't it possible they've applied some, not pressure, but suggested to the Japanese, if they are more sort of, you know, get more involved in Europe and less involved in the UK, if you know what I mean?
Raymond, I'm going to go live to Rob there for an answer to some points on your thing.
One last thing here. Hello.
Yeah, just quick.
Okay, listen, the Japanese were supposed to build a nuclear power station in Cumbria and one in Wales, Toshiba and, what was the other one, Hitachi. They both put those on ice as well. They're off. You see, things are happening. Right, thank you, bye.
Thank you, Raymond.
Of course, these are companies owned by shareholders. They are not necessarily doing the bidding of a particular government, although when it comes to Nissan and Renault, there are cross-shareholdings, and the government has a stake in, the French government has a stake in Renault. But when it comes to the state of British car making a couple of decades ago was awful. Does anybody have fond memories of driving a state-owned British vehicle?
They used to call the Austin Allegro the All Agro. It was a car suitable for market gardeners because the boot held 4 gallons of rainwater. You know,
Jaguar Land Rover, owned by... A Tata of India. You know, you've got Nissan, Europe's most efficient factory, Britain's biggest. I think it is foreign investment in the British car making, together with an awful lot of foreign work practices, such as just-in-time, which was brought into the UK, have made the British car industry the success it has been in recent years, together with, of course, the skill of the British workers and the research and development, which, yes, has in part been funded in some areas by the government, and also the training that people have been getting in Britain. That's one of the reasons that Nissan and others chose to locate their factories in the UK.
And also, of course, all the the racing fraternity, all the research and development, anything to do with modernity when it comes to motor cars originates in the UK.
We're going live to the lines, 952-78-4000. Good morning, caller, you're live on TRE. What's your name? Where are you calling from? What's your viewpoint, please?
It's John Dodd. You're getting me, are you?
Getting you loud and clear, John.
Okay, and it's D-O-double-D. John, leave a space, Dodd, D-O-double-D.
Yes, John. What's your viewpoint, please?
Beast, and then you can find me on Top Gear.
Yeah, well, what's your viewpoint, please, John?
The viewpoint is the motor. There's a lady before said there's no truth in anything, no facts or anything, about especially about the motor cars. I have a large garage, I can prove that. But let me get back to the other thing, the common market thing. The Irish Tiger borrowed, well, didn't borrow, it was given $8 billion. Portugal was given, I think, $12 billion. Spain has been given another $12 billion. The whole European community has been lending, Italy, I think, $15 billion. You guys can correct me on the different figures, but they're all in the billions. And there are several other countries. France got a big handout.
From whom exactly, John?
Well, the thing is, isn't it a case of one bankrupt organisation has another bankrupt organisation, namely the UK, that wants to leave? Well, none of it makes any bloody sense, does it, when you work it out? They're all bankrupt. The EU keeps printing the stuff and giving it. Oh, Greek had $35 billion. I mean, you couldn't make it up, can you?
John, thanks for your call in there. Rex, and I can join the other John.
Yeah, OK. I'm sort of half associated with the Midlands. I kind of come from the car industry type area as well. Spent a lot of time up there and know quite a lot of people that were involved in it in the days when we did have a British car industry, when they were British-owned. And the part of the problem with all of this is centralisation. When they invented that marvellous organisation of the British car industry, the British, what was it called?
BMC.
That's right, the BMC. They kind of did that to try and centralise and bring everything together. It all makes perfectly good sense. Unfortunately, it doesn't work because cars are basically an innovative thing. You need to have innovators, and innovators don't work for centralised systems. It's as simple as that. So by destroying that, whether it be deliberately at the time or part of a long-term plan, certainly it was within the scheme of the we've just joined the common market and this is all going to be great and let's actually have our Renaults and our Peugeots and everything coming in. Wow, we don't need British cars anymore. It destroyed the industry. It's as simple as that. And I actually spoke to an engineer there. It said to me, and I was in the service industry, so I was guilty. It said, you guys are actually destroying this country. You're turning it into a service industry country. You're destroying our engineering. And we did.
Well, aren't people better off now than they have ever been in the UK? You know, at the moment, we've got unemployment at a 40-year low. Wages are rising in real terms, you know, when you take into account of price rises in the shops. Finally, after many long years of people feeling a bit poorer off after the financial crisis, you know, the service sector, retail, has provided many, many millions of jobs for people in Britain, people who might not want to work in a factory.
And we're going to be going, thanks for the call in so far, we're going to go to Dmitry Gorobinsky, a former Australian trade negotiator at the WTO and founder of Explain Trade, speaking with him about what WTO rules will mean in the event of a no-deal Brexit. Speaking to him after this.
Talk Radio Europe.
Viewpoint with Giles Brown.
Always live to listen to Viewpoint on TRE Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain. 952-78-4000, the phone number, studio at tre.radio, the email, the Facebook page, if you wish to leave a post, is Talk Radio Europe Official, and you can WhatsApp me on +34 645 99 67 95. Joined in the studio by John Harper, Rex Leyland and Rob Young. And it is to Rob Young we go to just explain about WTO before we go to Dimitri.
So there are 52 days, 13 hours, 29 minutes and 26 seconds to go until Britain is due to leave the European Union.
Marvellous.
It may be delayed, of course, but Theresa May, the British Prime Minister, says it will absolutely not be. The UK will leave at the end of March. And so she is trying to get a deal, some kind of a deal done, that can get through the House of Commons. And if that happens, then, in a sense, nothing will change until the end of next year. Britain will continue to trade on the same terms with the European Union as it does. There will just be one key difference, which is that Britain will not be in the room making those rules, because it will have left the European Union, but everything else will continue as before. And I think the UK is going to hand over something like £39 billion over the next few years. If there is no deal, then Britain will trade with the European Union on what are called WTO terms, World Trade Organization terms, this global body of 160-odd countries, which is the place you go when you want to do a trade deal. And WTO terms kind of get thrown around by politicians on kind of both, maybe there are more than two, on all sides of this argument, because they're quite complex, and I'm not sure everybody necessarily understands what they mean.
Well, to explain a little bit more about that, hopefully I'm going to be joined live on the line by Dominic Grozobinski, founder of Explain Trade and former Australian trade negotiator at the WTO. Dimitri, good morning to you.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, here in wonderful Spain. So we're here, WTO being bandied about. I've got a couple of questions in from listeners, starting off with this one saying, some say it would be easy for the UK to trade on WTO rules, but we hear that no other country trades solely on WTO rules. Is that correct? And how long do trade deals take to complete?
Sure. So WTO rules are an absolute baseline. It's like a minimum level of messing with one another's trade that all the 164 WTO members have signed up to. They said, look, this is the minimum kind of level of access we will provide to your goods without the government interfering. The absolute maximum tariffs we'll set and so on and so forth. So basically, the closest equivalent would be in a no-deal scenario, the EU is then obliged to treat UK's goods and UK services the way it does Venezuela's. That baseline, because it had to be agreed, eventually 164 ways, is a very low threshold. So just about every WTO member has then gone out to its friends and its neighbors and said, let's sign agreements to do better than that, to build on that. The EU single market is the absolute most advanced version of that. It's gone well beyond the WTO rules. So in a no-deal scenario, while the UK can trade, the conditions under which it can trade and the amount of products it can trade into the EU, the tariffs it'll face with the EU go from being the lowest of basically anyone to being the highest of any WTO member. And that's a pretty big drop. As to the second part of your question, look, they vary. But to give you a sense of how long FTAs take, the EU-Canada FTA took somewhere between 7 and 10 years. The fastest FTAs clock in somewhere at around 11 to 14 months, but they are between countries with economic relationships nowhere near the sophistication and complexity of the UK and EU trying to untangle its relationships.
Dimitri, it's Rob here, but you say that they're complex and they're tangled, but that also means that they have identical rules today. So usually in a free trade negotiation, it is two sides with totally different systems and standards trying to work out how they can marry them together. Whereas in this case, everything's the same. So surely the negotiations wouldn't take that long.
Everything's the same, sure, in terms of how it is now. But in a trade agreement, what you're basically saying is, what can we put in place going forward to provide certainty that they will remain the same and that we can keep them that way? But the simple fact of the matter is that post no deal, yes, there's standards alignment still in place, but the tariffs go back up to WTO levels. The services market access goes back to all of those other things reset. So while you do start at a base of standards and regulatory alignment, you, in a way, the UK has to separate and create entirely new structures, but everything else would have to be negotiated, potentially tariff line by tariff line, service sector by service sector, area by area. So it's possible that they could do it a little bit faster, but I would only say, look at how long it took them to get the withdrawal agreement, which was simply kind of what are the conditions that we separate on without even talking about the future relationship. That took months and months and months and months to negotiate, and that is nowhere near the complexity or kind of the long-term permanency of a future relationship trade agreement. So I would be cautious.
John.
Dimitri, as far as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm sure you probably have more information than I do, but 85% of Britain's exports are already done on World Trade Organization rules to non-EU countries. It's 15% that seems to go to the EU. So, I mean, does that mean that all those are rules that are already there for the 85% of businesses that trade outside would change?
I don't believe that percentage is accurate. I think it's much closer to about 50-50 in terms of just members. Does it go to an EU member or does it go to a non-EU member?
I looked this up, actually, just last night for the purposes of this phone. 44% of UK exports go to the European Union.
Right. And then another large chunk of it would go to countries to countries with which the EU and the UK through the EU has a free trade agreement. So that's another big chunk. And then a large chunk of that trade would also be covered by arrangements like mutual recognition agreements that the EU has, where, for example, the European Union has said, listen, US laboratory, if you say that this meets our EU standards on engines, then you don't have to get that tested again in the EU. So there's a whole system of agreements in place that enable trade, even with countries where the EU doesn't have an advanced free trade agreement. So it's not quite that simple, I'm afraid.
And you've also highlighted what you call sort of four potential pain points: market access, you've got paperwork, administration and legalities, and also you've got supply chain disruption.
Yeah, so the European Union project, the single market, the whole idea was to try to make it as seamless in terms of bureaucracy, in terms of payments, in terms of just kind of headaches to get something from Berlin to London, to make that as easy as getting it from Kent to London. That was the kind of idea, and that's been around for a while, and it's been building up and building up. So if you were designing... if you were building a business or you were looking at a process, it made a lot of sense to say, hey, instead of building 27 factories that produce this widget in 27 countries, why don't we build one giant factory in one country? And then we can use this seamless transition to easily get stuff into all of the other countries, and then they can build on it and they can specialize in something else. So that's kind of supply chain. That's how a lot of modern manufacturing is done. It allows countries to specialize and have larger economies of scale. When you dismantle that by leaving the single market and the customs union, there is a lot of bureaucracy and delays and costs involved with trading across borders. Governments tend to want to know what you're bringing in. They tend to want you to pay tariffs. They tend to want you to meet their standards.
Yesterday, the HM Revenue and Customs in the UK said that for the period of a year, if there's no deal, that British companies can import the way they do now, and there won't be all this kind of paperwork. And so, because the systems largely aren't in place, I suspect. And so won't it be the case that, given that no deal has a kind of a bit of a big PR problem, because a lot of big companies have come out and said this is the worst thing in history ever, that there's now this thing called a managed no deal, which is that the UK and the EU say, right, there's not going to be a deal in place at the end of March or whenever, so let's put in place lots of side deals to make sure that things broadly continue as they do now, that planes can still fly and land, that the Channel Tunnel can still operate, people can still go on holiday, move around for business and all that kind of stuff. And so it won't actually be as horrendous as some people are saying.
So two points on that. What Her Majesty's Customs have said is that what they will do is basically let you do your border formalities afterwards. So you do a pre-notification online, and then you drive your truck off the ferry, and then you have a month to basically tell Her Majesty's Royal Customs what was in your truck and then pay tariffs on it. So what they've essentially done is put EU exports on the honor system. Now, you know, that's a temporary solution, and it doesn't necessarily solve the problem of supply chains in the long term, because that can't last forever. No government is comfortable in perpetuity of simply trusting that that trucks are carrying what they say they're carrying a month later. But the other question, so this kind of notion of side deals, it's important to understand the EU is about 50 years of integration. It is thousands of agreements. So I think it's incredibly commendable the work that is being done by the civil service, in fact, on both sides, to try to put in place these side deals as quickly as possible. But it's a lot to replicate. And as kind of the Institute for Government and others have noted, there are entire regulatory bodies and agencies that the UK will need to have that it does not have yet in order to make all of this work. So it's kind of, there are certainly signs of hope, and there are certainly good progress being made. But the complexity here is absolutely staggering and terrifying. So it's not worth getting complacent just quite yet.
Dimitri, a question in from listeners again, saying, I heard Conservative MP Esther McVeigh say on Andrew Neil's programme last week that we can use, she's called it Article 24 GATT to trade. She also said there would be a no-deal implementation period. Is that right?
So what Article 24 of the General Agreements on Tariffs and Trade, the GATT, does is it's basically the part of the WTO rules that lets you have free trade agreements and customs unions. So if the UK and EU were to sign a free trade agreement, like tomorrow, for example, then Article 24 would let the UK and EU trade on the terms of that free trade agreement. The problem is that the whole thing of a no deal is that there is no agreement with the EU. Well, what Esther McVeigh is, I suspect what she is referring to is an article from The Express that is the bane of every WTO expert's life for the last year, which basically alluded to this Article 24 as like a secret weapon the UK has, which misinterpreted a provision in it that, to suggest that somehow the UK could use Article 24 to somehow force an unwilling EU to keep things exactly the same way, even in a no deal. It doesn't really work that way. So in a way, Article 24, if there is like a deal after no deal, then Article 24 could allow that deal to happen. That deal would be a free trade agreement. But otherwise, it's not hugely relevant, I'm afraid.
Richard in London is saying, a period of a year, what about after that? And that's just HMRC. What about France, Netherlands, Denmark, Ireland, Spain? And also coming in from Simon, who said, have all 160 countries in the WTO agreed to allow the UK to trade?
So two good questions. The first one is what Her Majesty's Royal Customs have said is that they will give businesses a year's notice before they change this new system. So it doesn't mean it'll last a year. It could last longer. All they've said is, listen, this is the plan for now, and we'll give you at least 12 months heads up, business, if we decide to wind it back. He's exactly right to say that so far the European Union has given no indication that they plan to reciprocate by also putting all of their ports on the honor system where the UK is concerned, and how much disruption that flows back towards the UK is uncertain. So, for example, if you have a traffic jam at Calais because they're doing everything by the book, how does that impact Dover? It is not entirely clear. Like, this is all very fluid, but it's the exact right concern. As to the other question, the members of WTO don't have to agree to let the UK trade because the UK is already a fully fledged WTO member. The only outstanding question that the UK currently has in the WTO is over what's called its schedules of commitment, which is basically a document that outlines the specific promises the UK is considered to have made to the membership on what, how high its tariffs are allowed to be and what is the minimum level of access it provides for services. Now, members have indicated that they're not happy with what the UK has submitted, but that doesn't really impact, that doesn't impact trade. The UK can still trade on what they say their tariffs and services access regime is. The only thing it means is that members have reserved the right to, in the future, potentially raise disputes in the WTO saying, hey, UK, you're giving us less access than you should be. But that's kind of a long way down the pipe. And frankly, if you are if you're an EU or UK citizen who is concerned about Brexit, my advice to you is don't worry about the WTO scheduling issue. It's like number 197 of the potential problems from Brexit, and it's very far down that list.
Rex wants to come in on the point. Rex.
Just a quickie. surely trading with on WTO rules, surely there must be a mathematical sum that perhaps you or others have worked out, that there will be compensation when we leave the EU, that trading will be what we lost in the EU. We're probably going to gain a little bit more by going with the WTO rules. We've got more business, more punters, more customers.
Why? I mean, you are still trading. I guess the fundamental question is the UK is still, as the statistic that was cited, the UK is currently successfully exporting, I guess it was 56% to countries that aren't the EU. Trading on, when we talk about trading on WTO rules, what we're saying is, what we're really talking about is the UK's relationship with the EU. So leaving the EU on WTO terms, as it said, doesn't really change the UK's trading relationship with, say, the US. So the idea that somehow leaving kind of throws open all of these new markets, there's no reason that would happen. Now, could the UK derive some benefit by, for example, cutting some tariffs on things that it doesn't produce, but which EU member states do? So they're currently high for the UK as well. Yes. Could they potentially do some free trade agreements that the EU was struggling to do or hadn't gotten around to yet, or maybe focus more on UK priorities in those free trade agreements? Yes, they could. Generally speaking, though, most trade analysts and most economists will say that the best thing you can do from a trade policy perspective is integrate regionally. That free trade agreements with countries that are 12, 16, 30 days by boat away are good and not a bad thing to do. But your greatest benefit will be by integrating in your own region, which is why the benefits of WTO, benefits of Brexit from a trade perspective exclusively. And I want to be careful, I don't want to kind of weigh in on the more broad Brexit debate, which includes a whole bunch of stuff I'm not qualified to talk about, like sovereignty and immigration. But from a purely trade perspective, it doesn't make a ton of sense to dismantle regional integration in favor of going more further afield. But that's purely trade, and I want to be really careful there.
Yeah, I think we should be, because you've got two factors here. You've got Europe, which is a group of quite a large number of countries, all of which are independent and without getting into their sovereignty or anything. They all have their own particular little foibles, like Spain and Italy and Greece and that sort of thing, and Poland, all sorts of countries. And then you've got the EU. And I think what we've got here is a situation where we all have to accept that it's quite reasonable for the EU to get very upset about England leaving. And certainly if they take their 39 billion with them, that would really upset
Great Britain, actually. I mean, is the rest of taking the rest of them with them? You said England.
Oh, sorry. I said English. I mustn't say English, must be. There'll be, obviously, if the UK actually leave with their 39 billion and a world trade agreement clutched in their hands and say bye-bye, it's going to upset the EU. So it's quite reasonable that the EU would try and actually defend themselves by attacking the UK in any way and best way that they can. Not the first time. Happened in English history. So, I mean, basically, I sense you're dealing it from the World Trade Organization. I actually right in the other end there. I'm listening to an awful lot of people who are members of that 17.4 million people who said they want to leave. And the general sentiment is they really don't care what all the experts, what everybody says and all the best advice. They really, truly do not care. They just say, we decided to leave. We're going to leave. And everything that the EU has done since we've told them we're going to leave has persuaded us that we really, really want to leave. And we don't care what you say. So that's, I think, the problem. You've got the experts and all of the very reasonable people on one side who've analysed it, and they're quite correct, and it probably from an integrated point of view, yes, it's obviously easier to do all this sort of thing. And then you've got the people who just say, actually, we don't want it. And we are leaving on the 29th of March. Even if the country doesn't, the people will have left the EU psychologically.
So certainly Theresa May is clear that, as far as she's concerned, Britain will leave on the 29th of March. She will go to Brussels at some point in the next week or so, we think, to try to come up with some new kind of deal to replace what's called the backstop, this insurance policy over the Northern Ireland border, which would, she hopes, persuade the Brexiteers and her party to vote for her deal. Because at the moment, Number 10 seems concerned with keeping the Conservative Party together. Yeah. Because, you know, there is a deal to be done with the rump of the Labour Party that would get through relatively easily, it seems to me, in the House of Commons, but that would potentially split apart both the Conservatives and Labour. Yeah. Dimitri did say, of course, he was talking only about trade. There are, you know, people did not, I suspect, have WTO rules uppermost in their mind when they voted in the referendum. Issues of sovereignty and immigration were probably higher up the list there. But I'm in the privileged position of regularly going into businesses and talking to chief executives and also politicians as well. And while people are preparing for the worst in business as they would see it, as in no deal with very little notice at the end of March, there is also this kind of assumption that if at the last minute people say, right, it is going to be no deal next week, even though we've told you we would get a deal, that there'll just be a kind of outbreak of pragmatism, that at Calais and in Dover and at airports and wherever else, people just continue to do what they did before, because it's a big change, you know, for a bloke in a high-vis jacket at Calais to all of a sudden do something that he's never done before in his entire career, start checking goods from the UK, when, of course, customs are risk-based and intelligence-based. If you get some intelligence that says there's a load of dodgy gear coming in, then you're going to impound it. But it's also risk-based. The standards that products are made to in the UK will not change. The government's been clear about that. You know, they want this common rule book. British products, French products, German products will still be made to the same standard after the end of March, and therefore there's no reason to check them any more than they do today.
You're here live to the lines, 952 78 4000. Good morning, caller, you're live on TRE. What's your name? Where are you calling from? What's your viewpoint, please?
Yeah, good morning, Sharon Alicante. Actually, you're incorrect. Your BBC correspondent... I have to say, I cannot believe how biased the panel is. I thought the BBC correspondent would be neutral, but he clearly isn't. Is the BBC correspondent aware of two facts? First of all, Nissan are actually doing R&D on driverless cars and electric cars. That R&D will not be done in the UK now if things don't get sorted. You didn't mention that. And the other thing is... oh, God, I've forgotten what I was going to say now. But the bias, what did you just say? What was the last thing you just said?
I said that business leaders, I hope, that I talk to are preparing for what they regard as the worst, which would be no deal with little notice. But they also hope that there would be pragmatism, that people would continue to do at borders what they do today. I'm not sure why you regard that as bias when I'm merely relaying information I've got from people who run companies employing lots of people, putting food on the table for many families.
Well, you're also not putting the other side of it, are you? But the point is this going out on TV or radio or what?
This is going out as part of the radio. Of the radio, Sharon.
Because I just think that... we Remainers, Bremoners, feel completely left out. And I'd like to know. I want to say how grateful I am to Dimitri for coming on and putting the facts to a panel that still don't want to listen. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Sharon. Dimitri, thank you very much for joining me today on the programme. If people want to find out more about what you do, where can they find you on the web?
Sure. So I'm at explaintrade.com.
Dmitry Grobozinski, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks
we'll
so
speak
much,
again
guys.
In the future. Thanks very much.
See ya.
Viewpoint with Giles Brown.
Live and very lively from Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain. Rex.
Give me a second. I just wanted to read something out which I thought was rather pertinent to all our conversations this morning so far. It was actually, I shall read it first and then tell you who actually said it. The most obvious is the saving of our massive net financial contribution to the European Union. In this context, I am constantly astonished to hear representatives of British universities, whom one would expect to be reasonably intelligent, bemoaning the prospective loss of EU money. There is no EU money. It is British taxpayers' money recycled via the EU. And since we pay into the EU budget roughly £2 for every £1 we get back, it is an appalling, costly form of recycling.
Right.
And that was from Lord Nigel Lawson, which is quite an interesting viewpoint.
Indeed. Live to the lines, 952-784,000. Good morning, caller. You're live on TRE. What's your name? Where are you calling from? What's your viewpoint, please?
Steve from Cordoba.
Good morning, Steve.
I know normally I try to rush through my comments, but I've got 3 points to make today.
You've got one minute and 30, Steve.
I'll try and be as quick as I can. They usually say that in the USA, when they sneeze, the UK catches the cold. And as far as I can see at the moment now, Mrs. May is trying to follow along the same lines as Mr. Trump, in that her behaviour is becoming a bit wayward. Trump thinks that by forcing people not, well, because he wants a wall built, he's decided his opinion is the only opinion in the House, and now May is now trying to force her nonsense down the throats of the electorate. I'm a bit concerned about the Brexiteers on the panel, and I'll be careful now because there have been biased people on the station before. I'm a bit concerned because we have people like Stephen Ritson and Howard Brereton allay people's myths about wobbly bananas or other things that's been an issue on the debate. But my points are this. Hey, Mrs. May, she's shown that she's now changing the way possibly that people that come in after her will behave when they're leading the country. It's bad enough that you've got people like Boris and his mates who are impotent. I mean, they want her out, but they've not been able to behave, act, or have any solutions. And even though it's my own personal opinion, Brexiteers seem to have less of a clue than anybody else. And I'll give you an example of the reason why.
We're going to run out of time, Steve. It's your viewpoint. You're entitled to it. The bongos mean we're coming out to the end of the first half. We'll be back after the national, international, and national news. Thanks very much.
Discuss, challenge, inform, comment, viewpoint on Talk Radio Europe.
Giles Brown.
Live comment and discussion with studio guests. Viewpoint.
Always live, always lively. Talk Radio Europe's current affairs programme with a panel of invited guests doing a Brexit special this time round. Delighted to be joining me in the studio, John Harper, Rex Leyland and BBC business correspondent Rob Young. For the next 55 minutes or so, going to be taking your calls on all things Brexit. And also, we're being joined by the BBC's personal finance reporter, Kevin Peachey. If you've got any questions more directly related to your money, your personal finances, pensions and so on, Kevin will be able to discuss these matters with you. He can't offer financial advice to individual callers, but he might be able to help. Kevin, are you actually with us at the moment?
Hello.
Good morning, Kevin. Good to have you with us. Are you in London at the moment, or are you with us in Spain?
So I'm here in London, and the sun is shining. It's about 20 degrees. It's absolutely glorious out there. I mean, my mistake. Sorry. Wrong one there. It's grey. It's damp, and it's a little bit chilly.
Well, you've managed to get Rob of his sun lounger. You'll be pleased to know.
Yeah. He needs to bring me back a big present.
952 said, well, we'll keep you on here. We take some of your calls and we'll have your input as well. We go live to the lines. Good morning, caller. You're live on TRE. What's your name? Where are you calling from? What's your viewpoint, please?
Yes, the name's Terry Jarvis from the Costa Blanca.
Good morning.
Good morning. Really enjoying the show, but I would like to make the comment that, let's say, the usual suspects are hijacking it, where we've got really good people to talk and have some new ideas and some new perspectives.
Oh,
and
it's good to have you with
us. Going in the same direction. A little bit disappointed with that, but thanks anyway.
And would you like to put a viewpoint forward then, please?
I'm like everybody else, I think. I just don't know which way it's going to go, but I'm very interested with your guest, and the panel's excellent as well.
Thank you for your call, and give me a call on 952-784-4000, whether you're pro-Brexit, whether you're anti-Brexit, or whether you're one of the BOB, Board of Brexit members. Let's have a look at some of the WhatsApps that's come in, saying, this is one in saying, excuse me as I just do that right, British Brexit companies are considering leaving the UK for the EU to avoid the frontier business tariffs of the EU. Nissan going to Japan does not avoid this, so I see this as a difficult political reason. Also, somebody's just let me know that they're listening to us from the White Beach on Borough Quay. That's got nothing to do with Brexit, but just a bit of boasting there, I suppose.
Borough Quay, is that
Philippines?
Philippines, yes.
Philippines,
I thought so.
Very nice, too. Also got a listener in Madagascar. Good morning to Mike in Madagascar, and good morning to Cameron in Glasgow. We are indeed a broad church. Where would you rather be, Madagascar, Borough Quay, or Glasgow?
Oh, I'd go for Borough Quay.
Would you?
It's a bad third choice, but I'd go for
it. I'm going to say Glasgow to bring in a bit of
I'd like Madagascar.
Kevin, your thoughts on which beach you'd like to be on at the moment?
I'd like to be anywhere but this small studio.
Okay. Moving on from that one, anyway, from Desert Island Discs. Would it more be more sensible for the UK to suspend the exit and build the foundations needed for a seamless Brexit, even if it takes years, and then say, okay, we leave on just such a date and make sure the UK is already the UK is ready rather than just crashing out? Clearly, as your contributor is saying, it's complicated. One in from Peter saying, Dimitri explained, and we know that people aren't thinking. That's Peter in Iznacha, who said, so your panellists agree Brexit under any terms? Panellists? Brexit under any terms?
Yeah.
Right, thank you for that one, John. Lord Lawson is incorrect, but not for the first time. Facts and contents, please. Everybody is biased. And
that's an interesting point. Everybody is biased.
No, I disagree with that.
Biased.
And that the word is being misused. Sorry.
Well, because people have strongly held views doesn't mean they're biased. It just means they have views. But, I mean, when it comes to Brexit on any terms, Theresa May's been clear that Britain's leaving the European Union. Jeremy Corbyn's been clear that Britain's leaving the European Union. They are the leaders of the two biggest parties in Westminster. Therefore, the UK is leaving. Unless Parliament decides there should be another EU referendum and that vote says that Britain's not leaving. But the terms are utterly unclear. We just don't know on what terms we're leaving. And certainly not the terms of the deal that Theresa May agreed, because it was defeated by a bigger margin than any other piece of legislation that any MP can remember. There is a majority in Parliament, as we saw a couple of weeks ago, for leaving with some kind of a deal, because there was a majority against no deal. But just because Parliament's against something, it doesn't matter. It's got to be for something, because it built into law is the EU exit date of the 29th of March. And so they've got to agree to do something else if Britain is to leave with some kind of a deal.
And would it be so terrible that if we're forced to defer in order to get the right deal? I use the word defer temporarily. I know it's cancelling itself out, but if we could defer rather than rush and get it wrong.
Going live to the lines. Good morning, caller, you're live on TRE. What's your name? Where are you calling from? What's your viewpoint, please?
Hello, it's Steve again.
Yes, Steve.
Sorry to be a neg, but I've had to call back because I think this point I'm going to make is quite important.
Right.
The panellists have just now admitted that they are Brexitists at any terms. But as I've been saying, most of the time when Brexitists have their theories, they use terms like believe, think, going to believe that things are going to work out. And as Max used this morning, he used the word probably. One of the issues about Brexit at the moment is they all say something like, the Germans will always buy our cars because we're a big buyer of German cars, for example. The thing is that I think the panel confuses the point between micro and macro economics. In a micro situation, you're dealing with selling cars between individuals. And I think that they don't really appreciate the fact that the countries don't deal in microeconomics, they deal in macroeconomics, where it's important to consider the deficit or surplus of a trade with the country that they're dealing with. Now, at this moment in time now, I've sat and listened to these people, and they've never, ever given any valid reasons apart from just leave. When Mrs. May was asked in the House of Commons whether or not she had a financial plan, she couldn't answer the question. As far as I could see at the moment now, the country is losing billions, maybe, in the loss of the currency fluctuations and other issues. There's nothing wrong with wanting to leave, because I want to resign myself to the fact that we're going to go. But what gets my goat is that the Brexiteers don't seem to have any plan. And my last point is this. At this moment, people don't talk about the bomb that went off a couple of weeks ago. I think I was in London at the time for that one. And that was probably there as a reminder that May can't ride roughshod over people's interests, because at the end of the day, whether we stay or we go, the fact is people are going to have to get on afterwards. And I've seen no evidence anywhere of healing by either side to try and improve things after the decision's made and we've moved along. I'll leave it with the panellists to make their answers. I know they're biased, but as I said, there are excellent broadcasters on TRE who have explained the silly attitudes that they have, and that I think that these panellists should listen more to some of their other broadcasters, because they've explained issues which they're given bad information, and I'll leave it like that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Steve from Cordoba. John?
Yeah, very, very briefly, Steve. It's not a case of being biased. It's a case of being democratic. 17.4 million people decided it. Then it was actually put through Parliament, and a vast majority agreed to submit Article 50. Then it was actually put to a general election, where 85% of the candidates standing actually supported the factor of Brexit. It's the people have decided to do Brexit. So therefore, much as I appreciate that there are lots and lots of things that people are worried about on the financial side, the simple fact is, if we had not had a Remain Parliament trying to negotiate how we could stay in the UK while still fulfilling ostensibly the requirements of the referendum, if you'd have had a situation where on the first day after Article 50 had been issued, they'd gone to the European Union and said, we're leaving, you're getting nothing, we're going world trouble. ATO rules, give us a call if you want to agree any of your trade negotiations. This last 2.5 years would not have been spent fudging around with Remain MPs trying to actually cover their rear ends from their European subsidies that they get. And you would have had a situation where this deal would have been done and dusted, because at the end of the day, everybody does want a deal. You've got to ask for it. If you go there and say, what are you prepared to give us? And I'm the EU, I'm not going to give you anything. Why should I? No need to. But if you come to me and say, I actually don't really care what you do, I'm leaving, and you either do a deal with me on mutual terms that are beneficial, or you don't. I've got a WTO. If that had been said 2.5 years ago, we wouldn't be looking at 52 days and no this uncertainty.
One of the most uttered phrases around Westminster for a very long time was, no deal is better than a bad deal. And given that Parliament has said that what Theresa May brought back is a bad deal, you don't hear that expression anymore. It's pretty clear from the UK side and the EU side that they both want to do some kind of a deal. I mean, the Times this morning says that Angela Merkel has said that she will do everything to make sure there is some kind of a deal, because big companies are terrified of there not being a deal. Yeah. You know, the overwhelming majority of big company chief executives who I speak to, both on the radio and off the radio, want some kind of a deal to be done. Because one thing companies don't like, you know, recessions come and go. That's what happens. The economic cycle has ups and downs. But they like certainty, particularly certainty just 50-odd days' time. They want to know on what terms they'll be trading. That is why big businesses are putting pressure on the cabinet in the UK and on other governments to say, can we just do some kind of an arrangement so we don't have one big change to the rules come the end of March?
And our market, that's what we buy from them, what the British buy from them, is enormous. You can imagine the lettuce growers in Almeria who can't send their lettuces across to England, the Dutch plant flower growers, they can't send their flowers. I mean, and the Germans can't send their cars. I mean, it's ludicrous, the whole thing. It's got to be sorted, and there will be some common sense prevailing eventually. At the moment, everyone's still jostling for positions. But as Rob said, heads of business want the security in knowing that their markets are still there. Everything has to continue.
Kevin.
It's not just heads of business, really, because individuals as well want some certainty about their finances. And frankly, with a no deal, then that leaves lots of things up in the air, like pensions, for example, even people's jobs, of course. I think the idea of a no deal and the uncertainty it brings, obviously the focus is on big business, the focus is on whether bosses can plan for that kind of eventuality. But obviously individuals will find that difficult too, because frankly, when there's no deal, then we don't really know what's going to happen to our finances.
This has been one of the things that has really struck over the past 2 years that I've been doing this programme since, with the Brexit, Brexit was announced, if you like, or the referendum announced, was everybody was saying two things that are bothering us is healthcare and pensions. And these were the two things that we've had more calls on this programme than anything else about. And British citizens living here who weren't allowed to vote because they've been living here over 15 years, so they were disenfranchised, were saying, we didn't get a chance to vote on this. What's going to happen with our pensions? What's going to happen with our healthcare? Kevin.
Yeah, well, the pensions is clearly a key one when you've got, you know, tens of thousands of people who are receiving their state pension and want to know what the future is for that state pension. And that's the key. It's if we leave without a deal, then what comes into doubt is the what they call the uprating of your pension. So with your state pension, your UK state pension, will it go up by the highest of earnings, prices, or 2.5% as it does now? Well, in order for that to happen, there needs to be a reciprocal deal between the UK and whichever country you're in. So in this case, with Spain. Now, at the moment, there's a deal between the UK and the EU, and so it all works relatively smoothly, and that money increases, your state pension increases each year. Now, if there is no deal, then it all goes up in the air a little bit, because there needs to be, in effect, a set of mini deals between different countries as to whether they both agree that they will treat pensioners equally on both sides. So it can get very confusing. That's for one thing. And secondly, obviously, at the point at which if the UK leaves without a deal, then people will worry about their future, about whether this is uprated. Now, we'll turn around and say, well, hang on a minute, we haven't always been in the EU, we haven't always had a deal, and that is true. And prior to that, there were country-by-country agreements, which meant that someone's state pension would go up. That became simplified with the EU, but there's a chance, obviously, I have to go back to that kind of country-by-country agreement. Now, if we look on a wider, on worldwide, then there are countries like Australia and Canada where the UK doesn't have that kind of deal. And for that reason, people's state pension is frozen. And there's been a big campaign by various expats in various countries saying, hang on a minute, in effect, our state pension gets less and less each year. And that's the concern. Now, if there is a deal, then both sides have said they would like that sort of arrangement to carry on. So a UK resident living in Spain will see their state pension increase, and in effect, it's helped out by the Spanish authorities, and vice versa. A Spanish pensioner living in the UK will be helped out by the UK authorities.
Rob.
Now, the Spanish Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, did say, I think just before Christmas, that the rights of British citizens living in Spain would be preserved whatever the scenario. And he was saying that there would be some kind of citizens' rights legislation due to be debated past this month. I don't think we've heard anything about that yet. But clearly, Spain is thinking about what it would do for the 310,000, is it? I think British people who live, work, and have retired in Spain. So that is clearly there. But Kevin is right. The issue on the uprating is not sorted at all. And there is a very comprehensive website which the British government has set up at gov.uk. And you can go on there, and it's got information about what to do with your European health insurance card, for example. What if you receive state benefits, pensions, if you want to get married, if you want to drive, but you've still got your UK licence, all sorts of information on there, telling people to kind of Brexit-proof their life in a way.
And the Spanish government's done the same thing from their end as well. There's a Spanish website in English via Moncloa, the Spanish parliament, so there are, you can get information both ways, but it is that uncertainty that is worrying people. Going to go live to the phones again. Good morning, caller. You're live on TRE. What's your name, where you're calling from, what's your viewpoint, please?
I'm Kate Costa-Blanca.
Yes, Kate.
Just two very brief points. One of the panel seemed to think that moderation and common sense will prevail. Well, it hasn't done yet. And this, I am just so horrified at what seems to be an absolutely criminally irresponsible government, right from the day one when Cameron put having a vote, a referendum, into his manifesto for the 2015. There is no evidence of intelligent life up there. Secondly, someone said, you know, the trouble was having Remainers in charge. No, May chose to put very clear and explicit Brexiteers in charge. We might have got closer to a deal had people who were somewhat sceptical of the Brexit unicorns. As it is, we're running off the edge of a cliff.
Thank you for those points, Kate. David in Bedlam Manor comes on the same point, saying, spot on, wrong people with wrong attitudes negotiating could and should have been so different, Rex.
She put them in charge, but they all walked out and she did the job herself. I mean, why have we had so many resignations of these so-called negotiators? So it's a nonsense.
It has been the Conservative Brexiteers who have resigned because they didn't like Theresa May's deal. Boris Johnson, Dominic Raab, David Davis, they did not like the deal that she brought back. Can I just say in response to Kate, I did not say I thought common sense would prevail. I said it was the hope of business leaders that pragmatism would break out, that people would not say, aha, as of 11 p.m. on the 29th of March, we will follow WTO rules. I said business leaders hope that there will be a period of grace, in a sense, where things carry on the way they have for the past, 40 years?
Yeah, I mean, I think you've got the thing where the EU and the Remain camp sincerely believe that if they actually keep fudging this issue long enough, that eventually we will all go, oh, well, it's not going anywhere, we'd better actually just surrender. Let's all join, keep in the EU, let's have an extension, let's not lose the EU. And that's just not the case. They just don't understand the mentality of what's happening out there in the country.
Got a WhatsApp in here saying, the UK, and this is in caps, is Brexiting at the end of March. We need to find positive ways forwards, not bemoan the fact that we are leaving. We'll be back with more positive or bemoaning, and maybe some personal finance as well. 952-78-4000 after this.
Talk Radio Europe.
Your voice in Spain.
Viewpoint with Giles Brown.
Live and lively as always here on TRE Talk Radio, your voice in Spain, talking all things Brexit. If you've got a personal finance question, if you're worried about your pensions, by the way, personal finances, we've got BBC's personal finance reporter Kevin Peachy on the line with us, as well as being joined by the BBC's business correspondent Rob Young and, of course, Rex Leyland and John Harper. 952-78-4000 the phone number, studio at tre.radio, the email, the Facebook page, Talk Radio Europe Official. And you can WhatsApp me on +34 645 99 67 95. Kevin, what about thinking about private pensions? What's your latest take on and how they'll be affected when the UK leaves Europe in 52 days' time?
Well, we've been talking quite a lot about people doing deals or not, the politicians, of course. Well, pension companies have been doing deals because they've maybe set up subsidiaries or come to agreements in order to continue paying people their private pensions, often in a form of an annuity, which is obviously a regular payment for the rest of your life on your pension. So they will continue to be paid, but there has been a bit of work behind the scenes, if you like, to make sure all that paperwork could continue. There's still a lot of conversations going on about whether this can be made simpler, and of course it all gets wrapped up in whether there's a deal with the politicians. But I think with your private pension, assuming that your your pension company has sorted themselves out, and the vast majority have, then it should be fine. And also, of course, there's people's workplace pensions, and they should be paid. The government's been saying that they should be paid as normal. There should be no reason why someone with a workplace or an occupational pension shouldn't be able to be paid as normal.
Thanks for clearing that one up. Okay, John comes in. What exactly are the benefits of leaving against the obvious myriad benefits of staying?
Blimey. We only got half an hour left.
The benefits of leaving is that we don't get foisted into a federal state of Europe, which will eventually, if it ever managed to happen, become a totalitarian state and undoubtedly kill an awful lot of people, because it's not very stable out there. I mean, somebody was talking earlier about the ease of moving stuff from Berlin to England. And you know, my immediate memory was, yeah, I sort of seem to remember somewhere back in the 40s that there was a lot of ease moving stuff from Berlin to England, and we had a lot of trouble stopping it. So, I mean, there are benefits. What are the benefits? The benefits are you're actually going to actually find out how England stands as an independent nation. People will grow a set of whatever again, and have to actually start work and become independent, active people that are trying to actually make a go of it. England, I'm old enough to remember, and Rex is old enough to remember. The other two members are thankfully younger, much younger. But, I mean, I can remember when we were inventive, when we actually led the world in a lot of things.
Everything was made in England.
And a lot of things, yeah, were made in England. And you look down and say, oh, it's made in Japan, that's cheap rubbish. So, I mean, you know, I can remember a time when that happened, and I know exactly how and why England was destroyed as a manufacturing nation, as an engineering nation, as an inventive nation. And it happened.
I'd like to change the route there, but on what John says, but if the European Union is utopic, i.e. it's utopia for all nations, why is it that there are so many cracks appearing in member nations, member states? We have to immediately look at the Gilets Jaunes, who are a typical example of a disgruntled part of the population. We know that Italy's got financial problems. We've seen poor Greece suffer. The Hungarians are being rather aggressive. We have a rather rightish, more than normal government in Austria. And we look at the judiciary changing in Poland. But okay, you could say, well, everybody's individual, they're entitled to do what they want to do, but I'm still looking for this nirvana in Europe. Where is it? Where do we have this complete happiness that everything that the EU says is happening, and we're all living with no poverty, everything's fine, we're all paying our taxes, and we are going to live happily ever after. I'm afraid it's just not true.
Well, it's something that you've both kind of touching on a way there, is globalisation, that the way that the global economy works has changed. Economies are much more integrated than they were even just 20 years ago, largely because of the rise of China, and that means that now when you get a product, it's not kind of made in England or even made in, you know, France or whatever, because supply chains are incredibly long. Often there are components from many, many, many different countries all in one particular product. The iPhone, for example, is an American product, but it has for many years been assembled in China, but components in it come right around the world. And that means that that device is still relatively expensive, I think, by most people's standards, but it is much cheaper than a similar kind of product would have been had it all been made in the UK, for example, where you're paying workers a much higher hourly rate. And some of the problems that globalization has thrown up, such as growing inequality, have led people, many analysts say, to vote for Donald Trump, to vote for Brexit, to vote for the National Front in France, because remember, Marine Le Pen came relatively close to the French presidency a few years ago. And so that is, I suppose, the other side of globalization. We've never had higher living standards. We've never had more money, more disposable income in the West, the rich world, but equally an awful lot of people feel left behind. And Tony Blair has said, you know, Labour's most electorally successful Prime Minister, that if Britain were to stay, if the UK were to stay in the European Union, there are concerns about free movement in Germany and in other countries, and therefore he reckons there's a conversation to be had about perhaps limiting free movement within the European Union that may well satisfy some people who voted leave to vote remain in another referendum.
Coming live to the lines, good morning, caller, you're live on TRE. What's your name, where are you calling from, what's your viewpoint, please?
Yeah, I'm sorry to be one of those that keeps ringing in, but the chap who complained is perfectly entitled to ring and ask a question. I have to say, why do the Brexiteers keep on focusing on Europe? This problem is global. It's in Brazil. I heard in India the other day that they are trying to stop non-Muslims from entering the country, that there is an interstate fighting, political fighting over jobs, that some states in India are not allowing workers from other states in. This was on the news last night. Australia, they've been fighting over water, irrigation versus watering for the people, water supply for the people. There is unrest globally. It is a global situation. It is not an EU situation, and I do wish you'd stop being selective about the examples that you choose.
We're trying to keep this one on Brexit today, though, Sharon, so that's the reason.
I'd like to thank... Well, it is a global... Well, my point is it's a global problem.
Okay.
I'd just like to thank you, Giles, for doing something different today. And while we're doing all this Brexit talk, it's very important. I thank you to the financial chap who's... he hasn't exactly put my mind at rest, but he's made some kind of attempt, and I'm just like him to summarise that. Is it true? Because I've been panicking. I've been quite poorly over the stress of all this, and I'm just asking. Can I ask him? It's definite then that we still don't know whether we're going to get our state pension rises or not. Can he just clarify again? And thank you very much,
Chief. Kevin. Bye-bye. Over to you on this one for Sharon.
Thank you.
We can't clarify for certain that you're going to get your state pension rises in the same way as we can't clarify lots and lots of things, because we are still we still don't know how the UK is going to withdraw from the EU and the future relationship. Obviously, right. All of these things are up in the air now. There is a general agreement, and there's certainly a general agreement that it will continue, and that's the sort of thought from all sides. But we can't say that for certain, because no. There are so many things we can't say for certain yet.
Absolutely. Thank you for coming on. I very much appreciate you coming on and doing this. The final thing is the Sunday Times did a projection over on the state pension rises and working out roughly how much we would lose over 10 or 20 years. This was a few months before Christmas. And it was going to be quite a lot of money that the pensioners, state pensioners, would lose if the pension rises were not paid. So that's what, because initially I just thought it would be a couple of euros, a couple of quid a week, but it's not. It's going to work into thousands over 10 or 20 years of retirement. Thank you very much. Thank you. Cheers.
And I think it's important to be clear about the language there, about losing this money. It's money that you would have received if the same rules are continued, but clearly the UK can decide as well whether it wants to change the rules, which are currently called the triple locks, talked about
yeah,
a lot where,
yeah,
how much it goes up.
That would go for the people in the UK as well, wouldn't it, probably?
Absolutely, and there's been a lot of debate about whether this system, this triple lock system, which ensures that the state pension goes up alongside earnings or prices in the shops or 2.5%, that continues. And there was an awful lot of debate about that during the last couple of elections, frankly.
Right, thank you very much indeed. Thank you. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Thanks for the call in there, Sharon. Going live to the lines again. Just one second. Good morning, caller. You're live on TRE. What's your name? Where are you calling from? What's your viewpoint, please?
Good morning, Giles and the panel. It's Sean here.
Good morning, Sean.
I'd just like to, first of all, congratulate Rob on his very useful contribution. I must say, Sharon was expecting the BBC to be much more inclined towards her Remainer type of view. I thought it would probably be the same, but I think you've been fabulous, Rob. Absolutely fabulous. Very, very sensible.
Thank you. I hope you're about to say it's because I've been down the middle and I've represented the views of both sides accurately.
Yes. Well, I think also you've just given the facts, and when you've said something, you've said what business leaders or whoever have been saying it. You're doing what the job of a journalist is, which is to report, and it makes a refreshing change. Now, I'd just like to also mention, to put the minds of those such as Sharon and Steve and Kate and those that are understandably, especially those who are pensioners, understandably concerned about some of these economic issues. When the UK, I know it's not a complete answer to their problems, but the idea that the UK will be in some terrible economic difficulties as a result of so-called crashing out, absolutely not the case. As Modi of the ex-IMF argues, the impact of leaving the EU will be minimal, and accuses leaders of ignoring real issues of sovereignty and security to focus instead on scare tactics. And also, it's worth remembering that no trade economist, and Dimitri can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but no trade economist believes that the long-term cost of this shift in sales patterns, i.e. moving towards a relationship with the rest of the world for the UK, is any more than 0.5% of GDP. Throw in 2-3% of GDP as a temporary disruption cost, and that's all you have. Estimates higher than that are ad hoc. It's also worth thinking about the fact that there is a link between the EU's aims in creating a federation of Europe, ever closer union, and Macron's European sovereignty. The most durable ambition, a common framework for economic development, and happened when there was the overreaching of the euro in 2000. And that move was supported not only, we should remember, by Tony Blair, of course, but also by the majority of UK academic economists, how wrong they were.
I think you're trying to characterise the views of economists. I mean, there is quite well-known expression which says if you put 10 economists in one room, you'll get 12 different views.
That's so, very true.
And economists don't always agree on what may happen. Now, I think there were an awful lot of economic predictions before the EU referendum about what would happen if the UK voted to leave, which it did, and not all of those predictions came true, but a lot of them were talking about what would happen if Britain left the European Union without any kind of comprehensive relationship with the EU, and of course that has not yet happened, and so we don't know if those predictions will come true. But the Bank of England Governor Mark Carney did say a while ago that they had modelled what might happen in a worst-case scenario, and he was talking about the pound being worth less than the dollar, I think it was, house prices potentially falling by 30%. It wasn't a prediction, it was a scenario. But because this has never happened, in a sense, that you have, as one famous economist said, kind of unscramble or trying to unscramble an economic egg, you know, we don't really know what's going to happen, which is why there's an awful lot of fear among businesses and a lot of politicians.
Yes. Would you not say, though, that, Rob, that there is much in people like Professor Patrick Minford's assertion that when the mass media generally speak about business, what they mean is big business. And the interests of big business are actually, in some cases, directly opposed to the interests of small and medium-sized business.
Yes, yeah, I was saying before, global companies have big international supply chains, whereas if you're a small company, you know, if you're one shop on Gateshead High Street and, you know, you're selling locally made, you know, locally grown produce, for example, then, yeah, your supply chain is only a few miles long, and so clearly your interests are different. But I think you're right there, that the big business lobby groups do tend to represent big businesses. But the Institute of Directors, the Federation of Small Businesses, which cover members who voted for or advocated both Leave and Remain, if you look at their studies, I think in case of the FSB, it was pretty much 50-50, you know, there is still concern among smaller companies as well about what will happen, because if there is an economic hit after Brexit, they would clearly be affected too.
Thanks for the call, Sean.
So many new startups in the UK now, so many smaller companies that are doing exceptionally well, come from nowhere, and perhaps we're going back to our roots, you know, nation of shopkeepers, blah, blah, blah. You know, we are innovators. And also, the UK generally is still outperforming the rest of the EU, even now.
952-78-4000, live to the lines. Good morning, caller. You're live on TRE. What's your name? Where are you calling from? What's your viewpoint, please?
I'm Tigard Mitchell from Matheron. Now, I meet people making so many stories up. They don't know what's going to happen. They have no idea. They're just making stories up. And here, I live in Spain, and people here, they all want to stay in Europe. But, I mean, this is impossible. Every time a phone call comes, well, but if and when. Why don't people wait until it's all gone, until it's... You don't even know if we come out, we might stay in. That we, everybody's, that would be marvellous that we would stay in Europe. Yeah, it would.
Given the concern you've been talking about there, do you know people who are so concerned that they might decide that they're going to leave Spain, they're going to go back to live in the UK?
No, I don't know anybody who wants to leave Spain. They want to stay here. They want their kids to grow up here and travel about and see Europe and that, and they won't be able to do it because of the Brexit thing.
Because of the freedom of movement. Thank you.
I mean, I'm only telling you the truth. I talk to people and they're very, very annoyed because they're, when the voting was getting on, their voting even didn't go through. So if that would have all gone through, like French, Portugal, or that, they never would have won.
Thank you for your call and getting live to the lines. 952-78-4000. Good morning, caller. You're live on TRE. What's your name? Where are you calling from? What's your viewpoint, please?
It's John from Los Peligios.
Morning, John.
Morning to you. Unfortunately, I've missed 3/4 of the programme, so if I'm duplicating something, just shut me up. But I don't know if it's been brought up. Obviously, everybody knows this is a political punishment, not an economic one. With the UK having a $100 billion deficit, it has to be a political punishment, which is ridiculous that the EU will actually punish their own people just for a political point. But that's by the by. I think as we get closer, people are becoming to realize this situation, such as the crossings and what have you, all really defined Macron saying they're going to smooth as much as possible. But what interested me this last week or two, you've had the DBI in Germany, which is equivalent to CBI, and it's again a sort of scaremonger in reverse, I think, have come out and said that they've got to, EU have got to ease up because there's 750,000 jobs in jeopardy, which may well be the case. But probably a little bit of a scaremonger, but the opposite way around. Also, you've had a very high-quality economic economists in Germany of saying exactly the same thing. It's getting ridiculous that you're going to punish yourselves for a political punishment. And there was another one, the FPD, I think, or something like that, very prominent in Germany. So we had 3 prominent Germans coming out with saying the same thing. It is ridiculous. And I don't fancy being in Macron's shoes if the French farmers have to have their goods rotting in the fields or whatever the case may be, they'll kill them. It's now coming down to a situation which is more punishing their own people. And regarding the gentleman was talking about, they always bring up that 7-year with Canada. Well, you've answered that by simply saying, because the EU is equivalent to having 28 economists in a room, and they can't agree. And that's why it's so delayed. And most of the countries that have FTAs now will only take a year, because you can slot into the FTA because all the groundwork's been done. But we'll see what happens in the not-too-distant future. But it seems to be coming around a little bit that way. The Irish situation, unfortunately, being a half-Republican myself, has now become almost fighting the old wars again, which is not very good. I did suggest to them before last week that we should fight it out on the rugby pitch, but maybe that doesn't go down too well.
Indeed not. Thanks for the call.
Okay, bye.
So John is right that the UK has a trade deficit, as it's called, with the European Union, which means that the UK buys more from the EU than the other way round. I think the trade deficit was £67 billion for the last financial year. But if you look at it as a proportion, then that tells you a slightly different story, because 44% of British exports go to the European Union, but only 8% of EU exports go to the UK. So that there may well be more pounds flowing across the channel, but as a proportion, Britain is more reliant on the EU for trade than the other way around. But equally, yes, it has been long said that BMW and Mercedes and whoever else will want to continue to sell their cars in the UK after Brexit. And before the referendum result, German business leaders were saying that even if there was a leave vote, they were sure that there would be some kind of a trade deal done. And that is kind of, if you look at what's in the political declaration, which was alongside the you know, withdrawal agreement, the divorce deal that Theresa May negotiated, it was calling for some deep special economic partnership where there would be free flowing trade without tariffs, without quota limits, and so goods trade would continue as it does now if Theresa May's deal were passed.
952-78-4000. Good morning, caller. You're live on TRA. What's your name? Where are you calling from? What's your viewpoint, please?
I know, it's three times in a day. What can I say?
Quickly, please, because we're in the last 10 minutes.
Right, one caller found out, worried about the number of people leaving. In 2011, there were 400,000 people in Spain. It's now down to 240K. Secondly, Brex was talking about utopia in terms of, I don't know what his point was, but at the end of the day, if we want to take a quote from somebody, what about a Nobel Prize winning economist, Professor Christopher Pissarides? He's concerned about the damage. And as for Sean, thank you very much for mentioning me, but you don't understand why I'm upset. I'm upset because it's not the leaving, it's how it's been done. If it was organised and people knew what was going on, then people won't, there won't be a massive argument about the whole thing. But it's just been a botch from the start. Everybody can see it. And when you've got MPs who get 150 days a year holiday, 150 days a year holiday, I still wanted to go on their holiday skiing now when the Brexit vote is due. It's one of the reasons why I've got the hump. Thank you.
Viewpoint on Talk Radio Europe with Giles Brown.
Always live, always lively, talking all things Brexit. Got a question in from Simon. What's it got to do with Spain, how much the British government pay pensioners, and whether we get annual increases? That's one for you, Kevin Peachy in London.
Right, this is very confusing. basically, it's a sort of long-standing deal, a long-standing reciprocal deals that make it all simpler for people to be paid. But there is one important point here. You will still receive your state pension, and I think I need to stress that. It's just how much it goes up in the future that is under the microscope. And actually, the last caller made an interesting point about people moving. It's quite important to talk about property as well, and what happens, and I'm simplifying here partly for speed, that there are two relative schools of thought. One, if we have what the Bank of England Governor Mark Carney called a disorderly Brexit, and maybe jobs are affected, and there's a potential for house prices to go down, and the property market to be affected in the UK, if people still have a property here or if they're thinking of moving back. But there's another school of thought, which is basically nobody's moving at the moment because there's so much uncertainty. When there's some kind of certainty, whichever way it might be, then people might free up their plans again, and they might start moving, and the property market may sort of trot along a bit. So that's in a nutshell is a very good example of something an area where lots and lots of people will be affected, and we're not quite sure how yet. And however much we discuss it, it's not until there's some clarity that we'll find out.
I think I have to concur with you totally on that, because it's that wonderful word, sentiment. The sentiment at the moment is one of uncertainty. Once the sentiment changes, everything will be expressed in whichever way it's going to go, and that's going to cause a massive commercial rush.
And sentiment is so difficult to quantify. That's the difficulty for everybody who makes forecasts.
We're going to go quickly to the lines as well. A very quick point, please, caller, because we're in less than 4 minutes.
Well, actually, hi. Just to say, I just wanted to ask a question to the BBC News chap. And by the way, the exports, if you take the Rotterdam effect, it's only 41%. But I'd like to ask him a question. With the UK on WTO terms receiving a potential dividend of $4 billion from the motor industry, if we import three times as many cars as we export. Now, with incentives, why isn't there the incentive for the auto industry there, instead of having to pay 10%, sell more of their domestic production to the domestic market, which is colossal?
John, thanks for your question there. Just quickly, Rob, on that one, if you want to come back.
So the Rotterdam effect is, just to briefly explain, it's the goods made in the UK which go, yes, to the rest of the European Union, but into Rotterdam and then out elsewhere in the world, which is what he's talking about there. In terms of why do British people not buy more cars made in the UK, I suppose you'll have to ask them. Why do people decide they don't want to buy a Nissan Leaf made in Sunderland? They'd rather buy an Audi Q2 or whatever built elsewhere in Germany. I suppose that's, you know, it's a free market. People can buy whichever product they choose to buy.
Okay, on to just some quicks and WhatsApps and some studio at TRE emails as well. Hi, listen to the arrogance of your panel. England this, England that. My goodness, get a panel who knows what the UK consists of. Thank you, William. Also, common sense where? How would a foreigner be received by a British cricket club if he said, I want to join the club, but I will twerk your rules and play with my own currency, not in pounds, and I will decide to leave it. When I decide to leave, it will be on my own terms. He would soon be told where to go. Thank you for your programme. That's Mr. Rochley. Also, looking good morning to Alex in London as well, sending a greeting. Also, looking at that, the loss of manufacturing has nothing to do with Europe and everything to do with greedy retailers getting better margins from the Far East. So I repeat, what are the benefits of leaving? Ian in Camberley says the Gilets Jaunes, the AFD, the Brexiteers and the Trump supporters, etc., all basically the same people who feel ignored and hurt by the current status quo with nothing to lose. Good morning, panel. One of the currencies, current panel, currently refers to England, even the EU. That's good news for Scotland and Northern Ireland, as they voted to remain, I guess.
Although I have to say, though, you know, covering Brexit most days of the week as I do, Northern Ireland is the one bit of the UK we talk about most in this because of the controversial backstop in Theresa May's deal and the potential for what's called a hard border.
One in from Dawn. Enjoyed this viewpoint, especially when the B word is mentioned. My brain wanders, but not today. As for people saying the panel is biased, we are where we are and the BBC guys appear to be dealing with the situation as it is, not how we would like it to be. 10 out of 10, everybody. Sorry, what's that?
I said, thank you, Mum.
And one, just to bring things down to earth, sorry, your panellist looking through rose-tinted historical glasses. I remember the historical facts as well. I saw my father as industrial chemist being frustrated at the lack of foresight and underinvestment. EU isn't perfect by a long shot, but it is a work in progress. And also, why did we not mention what happened to the exchange rate pre-Brexit after the referendum vote when the rate dropped to 108? Rex, you're itching.
Perhaps John and I are known as when eyes. When I used to do this, when I used to do that. Yes. We are when eyes.
When eyes.
And also, a very quick one, somebody wrote in one newspapers about, so the supermarket shelves will be empty after a no-deal Brexit. That's the obesity crisis sorted.
Yeah, the federal state of Europe to which the UK played a part in. The leaders, Gilets Jaunes, are complaining about paying tax on fuel, and as a result, to displace their pleasure, they're trashing the place. We've only got 13 seconds left, so last thoughts. John, quickly.
Wow, yeah, I'm glad we're coming up 52 days, that's all.
Rex?
Wonderful, informative show. I hope everybody's got something from it today.
Kevin in London?
Watch this space.
And finally, Rob, your thoughts.
If you've missed the two-hour phone-in and you want to know what we said, basically we said we have no idea.
Neatly concise there. This programme will be repeated at 6 o'clock. Stephen Ritson up next.
The views expressed on Viewpoint by invited studio guests and callers do not constitute an opinion endorsed in any way by Talk Radio Europe.